82. It's July the 5th, 1982. That's a lot of twos. Just a few comments about the John Hinckley case, because many of you are reading a lot of articles on the subject. The New York Times had a front page story about the Hinckley defense. It says the John Hinckley defense cost the federal government $311,855. That's not the $750,000 for John Hinckley just to incarcerate him at a military base, such as the Marine base of the federal prison. The psychiatrist sent a bill of $311,855 just for the private psychiatrist who was supposed to prove that he was sane, right? And Dr. Paul Dietz, an assistant professor of psychiatry at Harvard, who coordinated the team, the weak prosecution to make sure that John Hinckley got off, he only got $115,917, that bloke. Okay, now the defense for, we won't even talk about the psychiatrist defense because the Hinckley spent their money, but the prosecution, in order to get him out free on the streets in 50 days, it cost the taxpayers about $500,000 for this one person, and he's laughing right now, giving interviews and laughing. Just in comparison, Artie Bremmer shot George Wallace and three other people. This is a presidential candidate and three people. Hinckley shot the president and three people. In 1972, George Wallace was shot. The standard fee for the state to do the psychiatric evidence on Artie Bremmer was $1,000. Yeah, some of the doctors did it for free. And Dr. Jonas Rappaport of Baltimore didn't charge the government anything. He worked for free on the Bremmer trial and charged us $106,751 for letting Hinckley off. That's our psychiatrist for the prosecution, okay? And the Washington Post had an article. Three Hinckley jurors had relatives in mental hospitals. Three of them had relatives who were mentally sick, who were locked up in mental hospitals. A fourth juror has an older sister who was treated for a nervous breakdown, and a fifth juror was under psychiatric treatment herself due to a car accident a few years ago. So that was five people, and that seems to be a little overload or sympathy for somebody with mental problems. The jury was stacked with five people, and that's an awful lot of people, and of course the sympathy went to his state of mind. And Mr. Hinckley, John Hinckley, of course, is giving interviews. I don't feel sorry for Reagan. I shot him, and his polls went up. Now, I'm going to do the rest of this half hour on a continuation of some very complicated subjects that I've been doing the last 3 weeks, basically called the Travelers. And this has to do with the attempted assassination on Ronald Reagan, the conflict of George Bush with Alexander Haig, the conflict of Alexander Haig with the Italian P2 scandal that's coming down. Richard Nixon and both Ronald Reagan accepted a lot of money for their campaigns from Licio Gelli, who's now in Argentina, Michael Sindona, who's now in jail, all linked to missing money in Italy. And as I said last week and the week before, when the conference was going on in Bonn, when Ronald Reagan had his first trip to Europe, and he's trying to be the great host and show how erudite he is, he's at Versailles and he's at Windsor Castle. While all this is going on, I mentioned that Roberta Calvi's body was found dangling off a bridge in London. And there were two articles in the newspaper that I read this last week that are very important to what was going on and what is going on to Europe now, in Europe at the present time. Now, Alexander Haig is directly linked to these particular people and the scandal in Italy, to the Pope shooting, to the military attempt of the coup in Spain last year, to the murder of Sadat in Egypt, and so is George Bush. He was entertaining Mubarak the day before he went back to Egypt when Sadat was shot. George Bush has worked with Edwin Wilson's team, that Task Force 157, as director of the CIA. So these two men are vying for a certain amount of power in the White House because the scandals that encircle them are breaking out in various newspapers around the country. And unfortunately, I know on the West Coast there hasn't been a thing about the material I'm going to share with you. One article is from the Houston Post and one is from the Washington Post. I take 10 papers a day, and it's very important to get clippings from 10 more even, because what I know is that the financial military center of this country is in Houston and in Washington, and there's information there that we're not getting, but which is affecting their behavior and what is going on worldwide. One article from the Houston Post on Roberta Calvi, this is June 20th, convicted Italian banker found hanged in London. And I mentioned that he was hanging off this bridge, that he was the chairman of the Banco Ambrosiano, the largest private bank in Italy, that he had been missing 8 days, and that he had $18,000 in his pocket. He had shaved his mustache. He had a passport to go to Italy. He had Brazil. He had 1 foot off the ground. He was ready to go to Brazil. He was convicted of exporting $26.4 million in Italian currency out of the country, allegedly in Swiss banks. It's hiding there. And many of our agents are running to Switzerland to pick up hunks of money, such as Edwin Wilson, who picked up his $18 million in Switzerland. Now, the important thing about Calvi is that he was leaving the country because he had been prosecuted for this $26.4 million that was missing. But the Houston Post said this: Calvi's problems multiplied in May. That's while all these people were in Europe shuffling around, when the Banca d'Italia, the Italian state bank, asked his bank, the Ambrosiano, to account for $1.4 billion that has been missing since 1978. The bank's troubles were cited by the currency dealers as a key factor in the plunge of the Italian stock market and the Italian lira that fell to an all-time low. And as of last week, it was May the 18th, when all their activity was going on in Switzerland, a man named Bruno Tassandin, D-I-N, was arrested on his return from Switzerland to Italy for currency and stock fraud. Now, Calvi started his bank in 1945, that Banco Ambrosiano. That was set up by Hitler's Gestapo, by Dylan Reed, by the United States corporations, for a Italian dictatorship. They had funded Mussolini through his early career up till the end of the war. When the war was over, the American corporations poured this money into Italy and into an organization called Permindex, which was the overview, the assassination teams that had offices. They had missionaries in Mexico, Oahu, Mexico, as trained assassins under Albert Osborne. They killed heads of states all over the world. They worked with J. Edgar Hoover in Division 5 of the FBI. Permindex was set up in Italy after the war, and Calvi was involved in that. And what they did was they take money from various depositors and take it out and put it into the International Fascista Group, the ODESA, Hitler and Otto Skorzeny's network to have fascism in every country of the world. That's why so many people who begin to organize labor movements to speak up for the rights of people are killed. Newspaper people, judges, civil rights leaders, such as Medgar Evers, and Malcolm X wasn't the only one. Vernon Jordan was shot by this team, and this Franklin's now being held for that. He's part of this assassination team. And the 30 or 40 rock musicians that were able to get the anti-war movement going, who could get groups to, Monterey Pop, a very popular attempt of people to get together and have a counterculture. Many of those people all had to be killed. The musicians, writers, newspaper people, judges, lawyers, anybody catching on to these death squads in many or most of the countries around the world are done in. And Calvi's scandal broke just at the time of the meetings in Europe, when Ronald Reagan was in Europe. And it didn't involve just his $26.4 million. It involved $1.4 billion debt that was missing, and the stock market was crashing in Italy. And coincidentally, there was what they called a newspaper strike, so that the newspapers aren't running Italy right now at this time. Another article in the Washington Post, an important article, June 22nd, Italian banking rocked by scandals. And this goes with the disappearance of Roberto Calvi. When he was gone, they were afraid that he would be murdered or commit suicide or talk or escape and be somewhere. They didn't know which it would be. And we still don't have an account. Of course, we know what happened to him at that bridge in London. But with his disappearance, according to the Washington Post, it affected the future of all the banks in Italy, the $20 billion in assets. The Italian financial world in the last 2 weeks has been knocked and threatened. The future of Italy's private banks and out of Milan, and again, the stock market dropped, and the banks are under a terrible bind and scandal. So one man wasn't just found hanging off a bridge, and that was the end of his life. This Washington Post has an article again that the Rome Financial Weekly El Mondo speculated that the Ambrosiano crack in the bank that Roberta Calvi had could have been caused by the Vatican Bank's refusal to honor the letters of guarantee of debts that the Vatican was asked to cover for the failure of these particular banks of millions of dollars and then up to several billion, and they refused, and then Calvi was murdered. The Bank of Italy investigation into the Banco Ambrosiano, that is Roberta Calvi, tangled the affairs in Europe, and it's taken at least a year, and the investigators hope that the details of Calvi's movements in London before his death may provide some clues. So all of this is going on, and this group were directly linked to NATO and Alexander Haig and also the Central Intelligence Agency. And as I say, the Italian newspapers have been on strike so that a lot of people in Italy aren't getting this information. Another article that came out this last week has to do with John Paul II's visit with Archbishop Runciman at Canterbury in London. And it has to do with the British trying to split the United States Church from Rome. But at the bottom of this particular article that I have, it was in New Solidarity, June 21st, it refers to Father Dulles, and it tells about the organizing of Father Dulles. Now, Father Dulles is Reverend Avery Dulles. He's the son of John Foster Dulles, who was the Secretary of State under President Eisenhower, and his uncle Alan Dulles was in the OSS and formed the CIA and set up those Italian banking systems with the assassination teams all over the world as the director of the CIA. He's the fellow, Alan Dulles, that John Kennedy had fired because there was a hidden government behind his back and he didn't trust him. Well, Reverend Avery Dulles, who now lives in Boston, has now been linked, according to this article, to a family that tried the second assassination on John Paul II in Portugal when he was visiting again in May this year. The Roman Church and the scandal of the Vatican are so tangled to the deaths and the attempted deaths and what Paul Marcinkus knows and what John Paul II knows that they've tried a second time to kill the Pope, and that gets more complicated because the Pope survived this one also. But this Avery Dulles left Europe after World War II as a young priest with Martin Bormann and went down to South America, to Brazil and Argentina with Martin Bormann, the man who took the funds of I.G. Farben and Adolf Hitler to set up the Nazi network for World War III, the Fourth Reich. So one article this week mentions this Father Dulles. This is Reverend Avery Dulles, who's now in Boston, who's been connected to the group from Germany, from Munich, Germany, and Rome, who once more tried to kill the Pope. As long as they try and they're not successful, the scandal gets even tighter and more people have to follow their bases. And that is why there's so much pressure, I believe, on Alexander Haig at this time. Haig kept pretty cool through Watergate. He's been a military man. He's followed the U.S. Army intelligence orders. The first time he publicly panicked was when Ronald Reagan didn't die, when he grabbed the rostrum and said he was in charge. And from then on, he's had trouble because George Bush Factor wanted to be in charge. And many of the articles that I'll share with you next week about the fight of Haig and Bush stem back to the very first day that Reagan was president and Haig wanted him to sign a paper that he was in charge of everything. Well, Bush wants to be president of the United States, and there was a long article in the Washington Post this last week that the argument with Haig had to be that Bush wants to be president. Haig wanted to be and couldn't win the primaries. Bush wanted to be and didn't get the nomination, and now they're fighting each other. But each one has his own problems. Haig has the problem of NATO, the Vatican, and the scandals of the would-be coups that didn't happen. Bush has Edwin Wilson and Navy intelligence when he was director of the CIA, and instead of cooperating any longer with each other, they're trying to cover their bases. So you can imagine how frantic they are. Now, Jack Anderson had two interesting articles this last week along these lines, and then again tying in the whole era of Edwin Wilson, because Edwin Wilson worked with all of these characters at different levels when Bush was director of the CIA, when Haig was active in the White House and military intelligence, and all of them can go back to Dallas, Texas, and to the murder of John Kennedy. There were two articles of Jack Anderson's on Edwin Wilson. One was last Tuesday, June 29th. a unique look at the CIA. And it tells about Edwin Wilson coming home and talking about how he smuggled weapons for Gaddafi while he was working for the CIA, how he infiltrated the Seafarers International Union that was set up. He was on the CIA payroll, how he worked with the AFL-CIO, which is completely controlled by our CIA, with bases in Nazi organizations. In mid-60s, according to Edwin Wilson and Jack Anderson, Wilson was setting up a CIA proprietary, a consulting firm in Washington, D.C., which became that notorious Task Force 157 that I've talked about. Now, Jack Anderson said that when Wilson resigned from the CIA to go to Navy intelligence, he got a fee, again, from our tax dollars of $20,000. So he took that money from the CIA. This is a little retirement fee. And he bought himself, as a $25,000 bonus, he bought himself some property. And he put $60,000 down on a 500-acre farm. Then he got a 3,000-acre farm that developed to $5 million or more. Now, Task Force 157 was set up from Southeast Asia, from Cambodia and Laos and Vietnam. It was the influx of heroin and cocaine from Southeast Asia. It was washed in Australia at the Nguyen Bank, and there are 16 major countries around the world that it linked up to Saudi Arabia, to Tokyo, to New York, and to our CIA, so that the CIA became the dope-dealing assassination team at the same time. They funded the Italian Christian Democratic Party. They killed Aldo Moro. Moro wanted to tax the Vatican's property. They killed Salvador Allende down in Chile. They were a continuation and extension of the Permandex organization. But now they could use the Southeast Asian conflict to rotate money and weapons and spread even to more countries. So Edwin Wilson parlayed his salary from the CIA into Navy intelligence so that, for example, when he came home last week, he had $18 million from Zurich. He has a $5 million piece of property in Washington. And then Jack Anderson followed that article the next day, Renegade's Ace in the Hole. And this is how Edwin Wilson would cause embarrassment if he had a public trial. And I tell you that Edwin Wilson will never have a public trial in the United States. And they give examples of how he served as Hubert Humphrey's aide in 1964. This may be tell you the inroads of how Hubert Humphrey could pick up a touch of cancer and be neutralized as a political figure, such as Jack Ruby and Martha Mitchell and about 200 other cancers. And some evening, maybe I'll do just 1 hour on the cancer conspiracy and the political witnesses and important people that have died of these premature cancers. Well, he infiltrated the Seafarers Union, the AFL, the CIO, but he also had a very important role in the U-2 flight. He worked for the U-2 after the Korean War, the secret U-2 planes in California. He was in England, Germany, and Turkey. That's where the weather reconnaissance plane was supposed to have left from, that was down in the Soviet Union, that broke the peace talk between Khrushchev and Eisenhower. Eisenhower said, don't fly the spy planes. I want to have a conversation, maybe some détente, maybe a little bit of peace. And so the CIA dropped the plane down. Now, Gary Powers said that he believed Lee Harvey Oswald had a role in downing it. Lee Harvey Oswald worked for Navy intelligence, as did Edwin Wilson and George Bush and the gang. Lee Harvey Oswald worked at a Minsk radio factory with a man from Argentina that the CIA was protecting, their family. And Lee Harvey Oswald's role in the Soviet Union, that I've said, oh, for many, many years, my research led me right to Navy intelligence and the Nazi connections. And Oswald was, he was trained at the Itsugi base in the U-2 stations and in the Philippines with the U-2 flights. He was knowledgeable of the whole Pacific radio communications. This is all documented by his superiors in the Navy. He started with David Ferry down at the Civil Air Patrol, as I said before. So again, Edwin Wilson not only works with Frank Turple and George Kurkula and supplies Secret Service for the presidents and the assassination teams and the headquarters of assassins, but now he services as part of the U-2. The U-2 story is really the bottom line of who killed John Kennedy and the role of the Defense Department. So the ace in the hole of Edwin Wilson when he comes home is his role with the unions, with Hubert Humphrey, with the U-2 flight. Now, all he has to do is say U-2, and Washington trembles, because The one story they can't let out is the coup that happened in the United States. I could cite to you 77 countries that we changed governments, killed leaders, overthrew, destabilized. But November 22nd, 1963 was the United States. The attempt on Ronald Reagan in March of 1981 was the second attempt to murder the President of the United States in office. And the one with Richard Nixon didn't work, as Ehrlichman told you, they tried it. Now, I did want to do a lot on Bechtel, and I'll just do, I've got eight more minutes on the Bechtel Corporation. And I do want to mention some important links of George Shultz to what is happening currently and why it is so important to keep Raymond Donovan in power. The special prosecutor last week said there's insufficient evidence to go after Donovan. The FBI links to Donovan, Washington Post article, June 27th, he's linked to the slain bag man, the man that was murdered, the mafia head, and links to Vito Genovese family. And that goes back to the Kennedy assassination. I mentioned that last week. Now, Mr. Clark, William Clark, the head of the National Security Council, hired Helene von Damm. I mentioned this before. He was in UNIS, Army Counterintelligence. And William Clark has to keep the team in power that were involved in the Kennedy assassination. He came home from Europe in 1955 and has kept a tight finger on the Nazis and the Galen organization. And the woman who makes all appointments in the White House, Helene von Damm, has been mentioned on shortwave radio in Moscow and on various broadcasts as insisting that Donovan be cleared. Now, why is it so important to keep Donovan in? The documents from investigating the Kennedy assassination have memos of members of the Warren Commission clearing Jack Ruby of any link of conspiracy. And I've read this on the air many times. The way the White House is clearing Donovan is the investigator has found no evidence. He's clear because they found no evidence. Yet when the Warren Commission was doing their work, this is what they would say. This was a memo, August the 14th, 1964. On the conspiracy of Jack Ruby and links to the assassins of John Kennedy. In writing their memos on the Warren report that they were writing, they said the preface and conclusion is that the commission found no evidence that anyone assisted Jack Ruby in shooting Oswald. Certainly it is true that there is insufficient evidence, and those are the words used on Donovan now, insufficient evidence to conclude any particular person assisted Ruby. Nevertheless, we have not conducted the investigation that would exhaust the possibilities that someone did assist and Jack Ruby in the shooting or in the assassination. So they said what we should do, being as Ruby's still alive and dickering for his fate, is say that we have insufficient evidence because they said in their own memos we haven't looked into the case. Now, it seems that Mr. Donovan from New Jersey is an important person. The state is very important into a lot of things that are going on at the current time. It's the home base of Warner Lambert, where Otto von Mollschwing, the Nazi war criminal, based his headquarters. It is the base of IG Farben in the United States. It is the home base of a lot of the labor problems in the United States. And Donovan is too close to where the bodies are buried to have him fired. And the newspaper articles this week are very protective of Donovan. The president wants him in. The president has to have Donovan as Secretary of Labor as much as John Hinckley has to get off or Edwin Wilson won't be prosecuted. There are secrets that these people have that all connect to each other that would all go back to Dallas or Jimmy Hoffa and his role in the Kennedy assassination of John or Robert Kennedy or the murder of Marilyn Monroe the year before Kennedy was killed. The necessity to hold the line of these people must be terrible, the desperation. Can you visualize in Italy the banks with the missing millions and the billions? The Vatican is involved. The mafia is involved. The mafia is involved with Donovan and the Genoveses. Jack Ruby worked with the Genoveses. Going back 17 years of my research, these names are all surfacing, and the people that have to be let off the hook, such as John Hinckley Jr. or Edwin Wilson, go back, as I say, to the U-2 flight, to Houston, Texas, to the assassination teams there, so that what we're getting in Washington are a lot of excuses, a lot of cover-ups. You read the articles, but what we're not getting is a relationship of specific stories to events that happened in the past and that are affecting these people that are moving now. Now, Ronald Reagan is sitting in the White House. George Bush has won this struggle against Haig. George Bush wants to be president. He has the California team in there now. He has the power from the Hoover Institute, from the Bechtel Institution. They want to run the country as a business. And what's good for business is good for the country. John McCone of Bechtel McCone thinks it's fine to have Allende killed. George Shultz thinks that was great to kill Allende. He destabilized Chile. He didn't say that the American economy pulled their money out because they didn't want a socialist or Marxist government to function. George Shultz says the reason that communism is a failure is because it won't work economically. The reason it's a failure is that the Americans pull their money out, destabilize, kill the leaders, and say you couldn't make it work. Now, Shultz is the czar of Washington. He was the czar. He'll run more than the State Department. And if there is a let-up on some of the news next week, I'm going into the George Shultz connections. The Bechtel Corporation, incidentally, took over Dylan Reed, the large investment firm, last year, March 1981. And Dylan Reed handles the account of that diamond dealer, Harry Winston, the well-known diamond dealer. Now, that's the man that gave our dear First Lady Nancy $1 million worth of diamonds. So I'll leave you this with this one. Did Nancy Reagan get $1 million worth of diamonds, in quotes, borrow, that we don't know where they are and she has? And was that the way George Shultz got the appointment of Secretary of State? We know she likes diamonds. We know there was more involved in the Richard Allen story. It wasn't a $1,000 payoff. It was supposed to be more like $100,000 the day after the inauguration. The very firm that loans Nancy Reagan her $1 million worth of diamonds, the Dylan Reed, was taken over a year ago, and George Shultz, our new Secretary of State, is on the board of directors of Dylan Reed, who carries the account for Harry Winston, the diamond dealers. It keeps our First Lady as the Queen of the United States. Years ago, there used to be a scandal if a person working for General Eisenhower, who became President Eisenhower, had a vicuna coat. There were scandals of receiving gifts. But now we have our Secretary of State from Dylan Reed, on the board of directors of Dylan Reed, handling the account for the Winston, Harry Winston diamonds, and she's parading around the world and very anxious. She's worked hard with this guy. She's groomed him all these years. She has her diamonds. And so we have to get a man who has been part of raping the world, slave labor in Saudi Arabia, and I'll do more details on the conditions of working for these people. In the meantime, we'll take a break for 1 week. You read the news. I'll be back with you next week. And please remember, send money to Kazoo so that they can support programs such as World Watchers. This is Mae Brussel, and I'll be back with you next week.
You've been listening to Mae Brussel on station KAZU in Pacific Grove. She'll be back next Monday at 7:30 with more commentary. Stay tuned for the blues.